Welcome to the Psychology World podcast with me, Connor Whiteley, psychology student and international best-selling psychology author of over 30 psychology books, bringing you the latest psychology news, fascinating psychology topics and more each week. If you want to learn more, then please check out connorwhiteley.net/books. And don't forget to like and subscribe to the YouTube video or follow on your favourite podcast app. And here's the show. Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 258 of the Psychology World podcast with me, Con Wiley. And today's episode is on Why is each subfield of psychology an echo chamber? And it is Saturday the 23rd of March 2024 as I record this. So the reason why I wanted to do today's podcast episode was to celebrate the release of my brand new book, Clinical Psychology Reflections, Volume 4. And this book I think is really exciting. It's the best one yet in terms of the Clinical Psychology Reflection series. And this just contains so many really fun reflections. And I mean, creating this podcast episode was a challenge because there were so many brilliant reflections I wanted to put on the podcast, but I thought, no, I can only pick one. So this is the one that I picked because it contains a bit of humour, some real life experience that actually happened to me, and I think this is just a really quite useful podcast episode to get us all thinking. But sometimes that is what we all need. So I really do recommend this really brilliant podcast episode that I had a lot of fun with. So you've got that to look forward to in the content part of today's episode. But moving on to the psychology news section, we're bringing from the British Psychological Society Research Digest. And the first one is a rather interesting one. Child geniuses may not be ahead forever. Stories of child geniuses seem to be perennially popular. One of the latest appeared at the end of January 2023, featuring a boy who taught himself to read at the age of 2. By age 3, he had become the UK's youngest member of Mensa, the Society for People with a Higher IQ. Mensa admits people who score in the top 2% on standard intelligence tests, admissions is for life, and members don't have to retake the tests to prove themselves again. But whilst we often think of inner intelligence as being stable in the absence of certain illnesses or injuries, a major new systemic meta-analysis of data from 205 longitudinal studies found it's more variable across the lifespan than we might think. Okay, so I think there were two quite interesting points here. So three. First of all, that is actually amazing that a kid can actually teach themselves to read at the age of 2. I think that's quite impressive and well done him. I think that is honestly amazing. Secondly, I think why admissions is for life, when we now know there's research that suggests intelligence can change and it can vary across the lifespan, so I think Mensa should probably make people retake the test. It doesn't have to be that often, maybe like once a decade or something, just so they're still in the top 2%. So I think it's interesting for sure. And intelligence varying across the lifespan. I've not read the research, but I can definitely understand a few different reasons why, though. And to be honest, I think if you really think about it, it's just common sense to some extent, or it's common sense to predict it, and then it's really good that we've got the research evidence to support it. I just want to make that point quite clear. Because, of course, if we think about it in like a childhood, even throughout childhood, maybe up towards early adulthood, then there's a clear learning and growth pattern, though, because you've got to learn how to read, write, and then like you've got the education system, and then you've got university, so you've got the traditional educational path, But then even in life, we're learning like quite a bit, because young adults and like younger people, they're constantly learning about different like skills, and also the brain's developing. And even Piaget's work actually talks about different bits of our cognitive development. So it's quite clear that there's a lot of intelligence changes throughout and up into adulthood. But then beyond 25 and 30, I think that is traditionally why we don't think intelligence changes. But I think that even then, you're still learning through the years, because you're still working, you're still interacting, the world is still changing around you, so you've still got to learn, and maybe that might improve your intelligence skills. I think that when we really think about it, I think it was quite a silly assumption in the first place to have, to think that intelligence doesn't change over the lifespan. And I guess maybe something to think about is, and I'm sure some people would take this thought way too far, but maybe linking to today's podcast episode, what are our current assumptions in psychology that are actually wrong, or stuff that seems really logical to us, like intelligence being stable, when actually it's not? So, and this is why assumptions are good to have, as long as they're based in research. It's just something to think about. And the second one I flat out love. Do autism researchers' priorities match the autistic communities? Millions of pounds are invested every year in research on autism, yet few of these projects actually seek to include autistic people in their design phases. Many scholars and activists have called for more participatory approaches, arguing there is a disconnect between the types of studies that are undertaken and what autistic people and their allies actually want from research. Identifying issues that the autistic community would like to see researchers prioritise is the central focus of a new study by the University of Stirling's Edith Cage and colleagues, which itself includes a participatory design. Through collaboration with the methods of the local autistic community and including autistic researchers themselves in the team, they identify a stark contrast between researcher and community research priorities. Whilst researchers were more interested in things like genetic and causes, autistic participants were more keen to see research on mental health support, how connective tissue and mast cell issues relate to neurodivergence, and more. And if you want to read more about the findings, you can go to the BBS Digest website. But funny story about that, so I've got two things to say. One, for my own placement year as part of my undergrad, I had to do the gamification of autism, which I later turned into a book, which I think that you've definitely got to read that book. I mean, like, I get quite sarcastic in the end because the research is so bad when it came to these, when it comes to these autistic games. If you want a crash course in how not to do research, read that book, please. It's available in all the usual places. I mean, like, that methodology is so horrific. So bad. How these things are published is beyond me. So if you want to understand how not to do research, read that book and you will understand how bad autism research is at times. That is just my two pence. And oh my god, I hate it. That book made me quite judgy and quite strict about research. So some people do entire modules on how to be a good researcher. I just read so many papers on gamification of autism, and I got the same result. So yeah, so that was quite traumatic, to be honest. So but there's that, and like, the thing that I learned from that is that there was no publication when it came to the game, and also the researcher design, though. So that, I think, is a massive shame, because if you're going to create something for the autistic community, get the autistic community involved. Surely that's just what you should do as a good human being, and surely that is just common sense. But no, academics do not have common sense from time to time. I just don't understand why you wouldn't include the population you're designing it for. It makes no sense. And I'm not having a go at just autism researchers. I'm having a go at all absolutely all researchers that try to do applied research. And then like something else that I actually want to talk about is that on Wednesday I was talking to a fellow master's student who also did a bunch of autism research during her placement year. Well, yeah, and she said the exact same. I mean, like, she actually said this exact issue because it definitely made her open her eyes about autism research and also this massive disconnect. So I'm already slightly familiar with this, but I understand it as an autistic person myself. Like, I could not care less about genetics. I could not care less about any of the causes because the causes don't really help anything. What will help me is mental health support, wider understanding, connective tissue, I guess so, to be honest. But that's not really one of my personal ones. But to be honest, just the support and just interventions about, especially when it comes to social skills. Oh my god, if someone could create a social skill intervention that I could access, oh my god, I would, oh, that would be honestly amazing. So anyway though, so I just wanted to highlight that. And the last one is, elsewhere on the web, and quick, name a woman researcher. If you struggle for a moment, it seems that you're not alone. New research covered here by Rodrigo Pesca on Ghana, sorry I probably butchered that, for Science, find that male psychological researchers name significantly fewer women than their women colleagues do, a phenomenon that likely contributes to gender gaps in the field. Definitely guess, and to be honest, like, we should always try and remember as many good academic researchers that there actually are possible, though, like, regardless of their gender, though. But I just have to say that my favourite female researcher, to be honest, my favourite researcher of all time, has to be Olivia Loftus. I mean, like, she has just done amazing work when it comes to memory. I think some of her studies are just brilliant. Sure, they don't always have ecological validity, but they're still brilliant. They're still quite shocking findings, and they're just entertaining. And also, I really like some of the ideas that she does about about being a like expert witness, because for some reason I find that quite impressive. Like, if someone's a researcher and a expert witness, then I found that quite impressive, and I just like her. Granted, I've never read too deep though, besides from like some of her papers. Well, I've seen her mentioned on like the news a few times, so I think she's just quite impressive, and I think she's definitely like a trailblazer in the field. So I hope you've enjoyed the psychology news section. So let's move on to the personal update. So moving on to the personal update. So this week has definitely been quite a blur because I've been really busy, but psychology wise there's been a lot of quite fun stuff though. So last Sunday I contacted 31 very specific groups for my second psychology study. Granted, I send them a sort of blanket email, email though, which isn't something that I like to tend to do, but I thought that it would just be so much easier. And to be honest, I'm sort of under quite a bit of time pressure at the moment because I want to get tons done. So I didn't really want to spend tons of time doing this. So I emailed them and I've managed to bag the responses from different groups to actually contact and actually recruit different participants. And I'm amazed. I basically got 50 participants for my study in 5 days. So I'm really impressed by with that. So my second psychology study, I think, should be way bigger than the first. And because my psychology study ended last night, actually, as I record this, I managed to get 89 participants in total for my first study, which I'm really impressed with, and I'm really, really happy. I didn't think I'd be able to get a fraction of that. So I think it's going to be a reasonably powerful study. Granted, the data analysis I'm doing are correlations and thematic analysis. So yes, I will have to do a lot of reading for my thematic analysis, but I've already done the thematic analysis for my first question, and I've managed to come up with some code, so I'm quite impressed, because I've not done thematic analysis in 4 or 5 years, so I'm quite pleased that it didn't take that long for me to refresh it. So I just watched some YouTube videos, and I also just flicked through some textbooks. So I'm pleased that that's going well. And in April, I'm going to be doing a lot of data analysis for it. But then I've also been doing like other psychology work after my statistics, and then I've also been making like a good progress on a new psychology book, which I'm hoping to finish next week, just so it can be released February 2025. So I'm like looking forward to that, because it's a lot of fun that way, because it's on morality. Something I've never thought I would ever look into. But morality psychology is actually turning out to be quite fun, especially when you use just everyday examples. Like I was writing a chapter earlier, and to illustrate a point, I commented on speeding tickets, because everyone gets those. Thankfully, I haven't yet, and I don't really plan to. Fingers crossed. And then I've also been doing like university outreach work, spending time like with friends, both with friends and just in a joint life. So as always, I always love to hear your thoughts and feelings on today's episode. So you can always email me, ConnorWiley@ConnorWiley.net. You can always leave a comment at the show notes at ConnorWiley.net/podcast. And you can always tweet me on Twitter @SciFiWiley. I always love to hear from all of you, because it really helps make the podcast for more a conversation. Oh, and I also just wanted to say though, like, a massive thank you for all of your lovely comments that are coming, from time to time though, because I really do love them, and I do find them really heartwarming though, because I won't read it out, because this person has sent it to me privately, because I was like helping them with like some anger. They did thank me for my really like useful book and the valuable work that I do for psychology students. It's a massive thank you though, because it really does like warm my heart, and like that's why I do this. Sometimes when I think about giving up, it's those lovely messages, and knowing that you actually find the podcast useful, that is what keeps me going. So always feel free to reach out. I love hearing from all of you. And today's episode has been sponsored by Clinical Psychology Reflections, Volume 4. Who saw that coming? Thoughts on psychotherapy, mental health, abnormal psychology, and more. So the reason why I love these books in particular is that we all know that most like psychology books, they like have had to be very information and very citation heavy, which is absolutely brilliant most of the time though. And I love writing those sort of books. But the problem is that sometimes I feel like those books can actually be quite restrictive, because I can't always talk about like fact-based stuff and events that have happened, things that I've read, and I can't just reflect on them. So that's why I created this clinical psychology series, and they're always like quite popular, because they allow me to talk about things that we just don't always think about in like clinical psychology though. And also though, like, there's only so many things that you can talk about in the lecture theatre with seminars, etc. So will one of these clinical psychology reflection books allow me to do what is just simply a talk about that stuff. And I love talking about it. So I really do like and love these books. They're quite passionate and I really do recommend them. So that's Clinical Psychology Reflections, Volume 4, Thoughts on Psychotherapy, Mental Health and Normal Psychology and More. Available from all major ebook retailers, and you can get the paperback and the hardback version from Amazon, your local bookstore or local library if you requested. And you can also get the audiobook narrated by Artificial Intelligence available at selected audiobook retailers like Kobo, Google Play, Barnes & Noble and selected library systems if you request it. So whilst buying books helps to support the creation and the editing of the podcast, my time is sponsored by my wonderful patrons. And as always, a massive thank you to my wonderful patrons, which your support shows that you like the show and you want it to continue. And if you want to support the podcast and get lots of great rewards, now you can at patreon.com/thepsychologyworldpodcast. So that's enough of the personality. Let's move on to the content part of today's episode. So we're moving on to the content part of today's episode. So we're going to be talking about why is each psychology subfield an echo chamber. This is a great reflection. I really enjoyed it because this is just so true. And when you start thinking about it, you will realise just how true this actually is. Okay, so I'm going to be reading an extract from the book. Let's dive into it. I should probably say up front that applied psychology subfields like forensic psychology, clinical psychology, and developmental psychology are probably the exceptions to this rule. But I want to explore my point first of all. And I also want to mention the limits and drawbacks of this question about clinical psychology at the end. I'll start off by explaining this generally before I explain the flat-out weird inspiration that kicked off the idea behind this reflection. If I'll be taking a step outside of clinical psychology for a moment and look at the three main approaches to behaviour, we have biological, cognitive and social psychology, and all of these are fairly divorced from the others, and this is great, but it's also bad at the same time. For example, it is brilliant that biological psychology only looks at our biology and how these processes impact our behaviour, because it gives biological psychology researchers the freedom to explore our biology without getting mixed up in the cognitive and social psychology topics. The same goes for cognitive psychology, because it's great that cognitive researchers can investigate our mental health and occasionally tap into biological or neuropsychology without worrying too much about social psychology variables. Equally, it is so freeing that social psychologists can focus on how social situations and factors impact our own inner individual and group behaviour, without having messy biological or cognitive factors interfering with the social behaviour. And yes, I know there is some overlap between these three disciplines, as seen in brainwave activity, social cognition, and how these impact learning. And there are a handful of other crossovers too. Yet my point is still hopefully clear. Each subfield of fast psychology is fairly or basically exclusively divorced from each other, which has benefits and drawbacks. In addition, the entire reason why this reflection was actually written in the first place is because of a weird comment a friend of mine said. Now, as psychology students, we are all used to weird comments, but this comment I found really weird and quite mind-bending. Open quote. That's cognitive psychology. I don't know if you clinical people are into that. Close quote. Now, I completely forget what we were talking about when when this comment was said. But I remember we were standing in the computer rooms where we were all testing our participants. And when she said that, I was shocked for a few easy reasons. I will show you below. And just bear in mind that psychological, cognitive and mental processes are the exact same thing. So we have psychotherapy, clinical psychologist, psychological therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. Those four aspects are absolutely core features of a clinical psychology, and without those four, our profession could not function. But this friend of mine actually believed clinical psychology was not interested in mental processes. Personally, because this friend is a great and I really like her, I'm going to be a little kinder than I normally would, because this opinion makes no sense to me. Yes, my friend is a cognitive person by trade, and she's obsessed with cognitive psychology. But again, she wants to work in clinical psychology. As well as this, puts perfectly on from the last reflection. I really want people who will want to work in a clinical psychology setting to understand how clinical psychology works early on. Since if she did take any clinical psychology modules or do any sort of clinical research, then she would know without a shadow of a doubt that clinical psychology is all about the biological, psychological and social factors that interact together to develop and maintain a mental health condition. Therefore, the fact that she thought clinical psychology couldn't give a rat's behind about cognitive processes really hammered home to me just how isolated the theoretical and applied disciplines are. And this, I think, is a massive shame, because one of the biggest problems in the clinical psychology literature is that it is written by research academics in a way that isn't either understandable or usable by clinical practitioners, basically making the research next to useless. And yes, I am probably triggering a lot of you right now, but this is the truth. So this is a problem that might start to be fixed in the future, because I know there are clinical psychologists conducting research and lecturing at universities more than ever, apparently, from what I hear. But it is still a problem that needs to be overcome. Also, if it's a problem that starts with academics and people in the biological, cognitive and the social psychology approaches themselves, then in an ideal world, they would be at least given clinical psychology teaching or something by a real world clinical psychologist, so they could understand the practical side of everything. Since so much of our clinical psychology is about practicalities, and at least in the UK, knowing what you can and cannot do in the NHS. And please note, this is not a dig at anyone. This is just my opinion on the whole mess that we find ourselves in. Furthermore, what I really think about this is that communication and cooperation between the disciplines is so badly needed. I am not saying that the theoretical approach shouldn't do applied research, or per research that might be able to be adapted into something useful or practical, because that is stupid. As well as everyone in academia should have the freedom to research or whatever they want, as long as it is ethical, useful and legal. However, what I am saying is that if we ever want the researchers and our students and academia as a whole to truly understand the applied disciplines and what clinical psychology actually cares about, there has to be more communication and cooperation across the disciplines. And then that would have other benefits as well, especially since the clinical psychologists would bring the real world experience and clinical expertise to a project, and an academic would bring the hard science methodology that clinical psychologists might not have done a few years. There is plenty of room for both if academia allows it to. The age of echo chambers needs that to end, and the age of academia afterwards needs that to be more useful to applied disciplines, cooperative, and to have a lot more communication for sure, because clinical psychology cares about everything that would help them to decrease psychological distress of their clients and to improve lives. That is all we care about at the end of the day. So I really hope that you enjoyed today's episode and you got something out of it. Yeah, I mean, when my friend said that to me, I was shocked, and hopefully you could hear that I was actually sort of laughing as I was reading it out, because I was remembering it, and it was just like, you want to work in clinical psychology, but you think clinical psychology doesn't care about psychological factors. I mean, that is an interesting opinion. And the thing is, though, is that she's not alone. Like, there's so many students that think like that. And I know I probably have some really weird beliefs about other disciplines or other areas of psychology that I have no interest in. So I think it's an interesting one. And it just goes to show that we are in such an echo chamber, to be honest, even within psychology. It's why I never, to be honest, I completely fail with this, but it's why I actually don't always do clinical psychology episodes. I know I tend to, but it's why I always try to go outside of like clinical psychology from time to time, because I just want to learn about what other disciplines are doing, because I think that's healthy, I think that's good, and I think it's useful for all of us. So I might try and like do that again, sometime soon though. It's interesting and useful for sure. So if you know anyone who would enjoy today's episode, then please share it with them. I'm always really grateful when you want to have people help spread the word about the podcast. And if you want to learn more, definitely check out Clinical Psychology Reflections Volume 4, Thoughts on Psychotherapy, Mental Health and Abnormal Psychology, available from all major ebook retailers. And you can get the paperback and the hardback version from Amazon, your local bookstore or local library if you request it. So have a great day everyone, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. Please remember to like the video and subscribe to the YouTube channel and follow the podcast on your favourite podcast app. And if you wanted to learn more, then please check out the backlist of the podcast episodes or my books at conwhiteley.net. So have a great day and I'll see you next time.